52 years ago, Mark Crowley's The Boys in the Band debuted off-Broadway. The structure was simple and not unfamiliar to anyone who'd never seen a play before. Over the course of an evening, characters gather, get drunk, and turn on each other. Things get said that cannot be unsaid, secrets are revealed, curtain, house lights up. The groundbreaking difference was that it was a group of gay men doing all that gathering and drinking and lashing out. Now, a new Netflix film adapts the recent Tony-winning revival of the play, importing its director, Joe Mantello, and its all-star, all-gay cast, including Jim Parsons, Andrew Reynolds, Zachary Quinto, and the disquietingly symmetrical Matt Bomer. I'm Glenn Weldon. We're talking about Netflix's adaptation of The Boys in the Band on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me from his home in San Antonio, Texas, is Sam Sanders, the host of NPR's It's Been a Minute. Welcome back, Sam.
It's good to be back.
Always great to have you. It has been a minute. Also with us from his home in Los Angeles is Tobin Lowe, former host of the Nancy podcast, who is now with Radiolab. Welcome back, Tobin.
Hey, good to be here.
Always great to have you. And joining us for the first time from Beacon, New York, is culture critic and reporter Mark Blankenship, who is also the editor and founder of The Flash Paper, a print publication, kids, ask your parents, where theater artists respond to current events. Welcome, Mark.
Oh, I'm very excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. Now, the more discerning listeners out there might have heard the lineup for this particular episode and realized that the four of us on this panel have something in common. We all harbor complicated feelings about Madonna's post-Confessions on a Dance Floor output.
Oh, that's the hard
truth.
It's
not complicated.
Yes.
That was her best album. Everything else was trash.
There we go. Okay, let's get to it. Actually, this is a great panel. I'm really glad we put you guys all together. Now, there's a lot of characters here, but at least here at the beginning, let's try to drill down to the ones that drive the plot. It's 1968 in the West Village. Jim Parsons is Michael, who is reluctantly throwing a birthday party for what we would now call his frenemy, Harold, who is played by Zachary Quinto. But at the last minute, he gets a tearful call from his old, putatively heterosexual college roommate, Ellen, played by Brian Hutchinson, who is in town and wants to talk to Michael urgently for some reason, and thereby hangs a tale. Now, Tobin, you, among many things, are a young. This play is an old. It is, in point of fact, 2 months younger than I am. Tobin, I'm very curious what you thought of this. How familiar were you with The Boys in the Band?
I would say it's been on my sort of periphery for a while. I was aware of the Broadway revival, but I wasn't super familiar with the content of it. I knew the basic lines of the plot, but that's probably about where my knowledge ended. I'll start with the good things I liked. I thought that there were strong performances by Robin DeJesus and Michael Benjamin Washington. They're more side characters, but I enjoyed them. I thought they gave a lot to their parts. Zachary Quinto is giving you a full drag performance with his line readings, which I, at the beginning, was like, what's happening here? And by the end, I was like, work. This is a choice, and you committed to it. I'm all on board. But I think my biggest sort of feeling about this film as an adaptation of a play, I felt like it suffered from a thing that happens a lot in a play-to-movie translation, which is I wish there was just more translating in terms of plays are wordy by definition because that's how you do the work of communicating and you have to do a lot of monologuing to sort of get to know characters. And I wish there was a little more translation to a film medium, you know, giving some of that over to more interesting shots or something that really speaks to it being a movie. As it is, I had that feeling that you sometimes get when you see a play that's filmed, where I just sort of felt like, oh, this is a lot of talking and everyone's just saying what they mean. And I think it suffered a little bit for that. So that was my biggest sort of thought about this adaptation.
Yeah, this is very much a stand and deliver endeavor where people kind of are just as apt to go into a monologue as they are to enter into a conversation. And they also announce all the contours of their personality upon like entrance, upon walking into the room. You kind of know who that guy is. That's what happens in plays. Now, Mark, you have a lot of experience with this particular play. You've seen several versions and you wrote about this in college. So I'm going to go to you. What'd you think of this?
Well, I can't even imagine seeing this movie without the heavy weight of all of my nerdy academic experience dragging along behind me. I've had a mutable relationship to this play over the years. I've gone through phases of thinking this is trash, get this self-loathing garbage out of my face. I've gone through phases where I think, well, it's historically interesting and we should therefore respect it. And now I've reached a point where I feel like I'm glad that this play and now this film exist in the contemporary cultural context where it's not the only mainstream gay story that is being told. And I feel like because of that, I was able to have this experience of watching this production when it was on Broadway a few years ago and now this film. I felt like I was able to appreciate the story for what it does well, which is create, I think, a very engrossing sense of the relationship among all of these men. And I found myself being really sucked into their lives with the close-ups that Joe Mantello, the director, was able to use here, not only on individual faces, but on people who were watching from the sidelines. And I found myself very engaged with this story, and I felt like I viscerally felt its power, and I understood maybe in a fresh way why it was something that gripped people 52 years ago and why it's something that we keep coming back to. That said, I also think I might be good for now, for the rest of my life with this story. Like, it's a slog and it does what it wants to do quite well. And I know what it is, and carry on into the West, boys in the band.
All right. From a student of this play to somebody who is coming in absolutely fresh, Sam Sanders, what'd you think of The Boys in the Band?
So all I knew was that it is the latest in the Ryan Murphy Netflix super deal.
Oh, boy.
And I was already angry before I turned this thing on, because Ryan Murphy's Netflix output has been pissing me off. It just has. Like, they gave this man so much money, and he has made very pretty junk. So that was what I was feeling going into it. But because they stuck to the script of the play, the plot actually worked for me much more than his previous productions. Like, I could follow it a lot better. It wasn't jumping around trying to do too much. The plot was the plot, right? I think the acting was okay. It was over the top, but it was supposed to be. I still don't understand what Jim Parson is trying to do. I still don't understand why Ryan Murphy has made Jim Parson his muse, but whatever. He was more likable in this than he was in Hollywood. I hated Hollywood. I think that stories made by white people with the gays primarily focused on the white characters. The two characters of color that get to be in there as kind of sidekicks, I felt like they got too little time, and I would watch an entire movie on their backstory.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm used to that. So I think overall, I felt like it was particularly enjoyable. And I think what I really grappled the most with was perhaps the critical response. I read up a lot on this play after I finished watching it, and I realized pretty early on with this play's history, a lot of folks and critics were saying, it's outdated, it's retrograde, we've moved past that, the gays are accepted now, the gays love themselves, there's no more self-hatred. And I don't think that's true. And I think that the critiques of this movie right now today, saying this is so in the past and so retrograde, I think they're wrong. I think that self-hatred is still a reality for so many gay men. Mm-hmm. I think that so many gay men are still in the closet, still trying to figure out how to be gay. They are still overwhelmed by the pressure of being queer in a world that is made for straight people. And I think the critics who say that we are all past that, they're showing their privilege, and it feels a lot like the gays who think AIDS is over just because they got PrEP, you know?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yep.
And there were moments of this film that were really, really real to me as a 36-year-old homosexual. You know, when they get to that final scene and Jim Parsons' character says, show me a happy homosexual and I'll show you a gay corpse. It took me back to 2019 when my therapist made me read The Velvet Rage, and all of it still slaps. All of it's still real. All of these things, grappling with self-love and self-hatred as a gay in this world, in this country, it is real. So I think, ironically, I was most annoyed by the critics who act like this world doesn't exist anymore. It does, even if they can't see it.
That's why I'm going to go to Mark now to talk about how the critical reaction and the popular reaction, and certainly the reaction among the queer community to this play, has cycled through the years. Because when I was coming out in the early 90s, this play was not reviled. It was lampooned. It was seen as camp. It was seen as kind of, again, as you say, retrograde, because there was the AIDS crisis, right? And so when you have the AIDS crisis going full bore, these neurotic queens who are talking about their therapist, it just seems completely inessential. And you mentioned that line, Sam, about how, show me a happy homosexual and I will show you a gay corpse. That took on a weird new patina of tastelessness in the AIDS era. But Mark, can you talk about the cycle of reception of this play?
Yeah. Part of the reception of this play by the queer community has been down to the fact that when you were trying to make yourself more visible in the mainstream culture, it is easy to resist anything that makes you seem less than saintly, less than perfect in your difference, less than beautiful in your struggle. And this play, uniquely among mainstream plays and films about gay men, especially from that period, but I would even argue even now, this play does not care if it points out that gay men can be horrible to each other and to themselves. That has caused consternation from the jump, because the homophile movement, as it was called in the late 50s and early 60s, was still quite strong in this pre-Stonewall year, the year before Stonewall when this movie came out. And the homophile movement really wasn't happy about Dirty Laundry being aired out, because this was the gay play that made it into the mainstream world. Heterosexual people watched this play for years. It ran for years. And they saw the play at the time as giving fuel to a straight audience that wanted to find reasons to pity and revile gay men. It's like, how dare you make us look this ugly? We are this ugly sometimes, but we don't want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. It's easy to look back now and see some of the coverage as being, look at the freaks in the zoo about this play. And so it created this sense of frustration for queer radical people, and a sense perhaps of amused, detached, observational interest for straight audiences. But then by the time that the Broadway revival came out, famously it had a poster filled with gay slurs and then a picture of this cast, and it said the boys in the band. That seemed to be the moment that people were able to re-embrace or revisit what the play is doing, because like I was saying before, it's no longer the only story that we've got in the mainstream, so we can see it as a crucial part of a tapestry.
Now, this play has a reputation for being very caustic and these characters are being very self-lacerating. I gotta say, seeing it now in 2020 and closing my eyes, I could not necessarily distinguish what I was listening to from a extended, very special episode of Will and Grace.
Yes.
The rhythms. Ooh. I am not trying to denigrate the play by calling it sitcom-y. I am saying that the influence of this play is so strong that its DNA has leached into the rhythms of this dialogue, the archness of the delivery, the loucheness of the zingers. It's just that it has been taken up by hundreds and thousands of plays, movies, television shows. It just felt familiar to me. And that's what struck me, with somebody coming to this completely unfamiliar with it, find it strangely familiar. Tobin, you're nodding.
Yeah, it's so funny you mentioned Will and Grace. I had that exact thought while I was watching it. It was sort of this moment of like, I could appreciate what this play meant when it came out and sort of appreciate it as sort of this time capsule of that moment in time. But at the same time, I was like, wow, the rhythms of this, the jokiness of it, the sort of camp and the shade has now been co-opted by stuff like Will and Grace and very mainstreamified. And so it's one of those things where it's hard to watch now and have a pure sort of experience of it as it must have been received, because all I could think was, wow, this is what I'm used to out of a 30-minute sitcom on NBC now. You know, that's sort of like
exactly
portrayal of gay life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is important, capital I. Is it good, capital G? You know, things don't need to be both. Let's place this in context, because the representation of marginalized communities always follows the same four-step path. It's true for queers, it's true for women, it's true for people of color. First, we are the villains that the straight white hero must defeat. Then we are the victims that the straight white hero must defend, or in the case of queers, often avenge, because we die. Then we're the ally, you know, in the case of queers, we're the snappy sidekick who says, you know, go to him, girl, that's us. And then, finally, if we get the opportunity and the access to the means of production, we are the heroes. But the boys in the band did, it seemed to me, was jump the line. And I wouldn't call these characters heroes, but they certainly are telling their own stories. And what strikes me is that the lens through which the audience is looking at these characters, and you got to imagine some of the success of this play must have been people coming in from Ronkonkoma and Scarsdale to watch the gay play. Martha, we went and saw the gay play. We're part of the bohemian counterculture. That lens is not part of the straight world. Now, in the movie, it is. And Mark, I think you have something to say about this. But the play itself is not apologizing. It's not self-justifying, because he wasn't cheating out to the straight audience. He was talking amongst themselves. Now, Mark, you mentioned something about all the what has been added to this movie is a lot of silent straight people watching, which wasn't necessarily in the play. That changes things a bit, don't you think?
Yes, in a way that I actually found really exciting, because I think in a way it makes what was happening in the 60s even more legible for queer people now who maybe haven't had to feel this way in a while or don't feel this way as actively. Because throughout this whole movie, when all of the characters are about to go into the apartment, which is ostensibly the safe space, right? It's the queer space in the play. you see them all moving through the world, and every single one of them gets observed with disgust by a silent, straight person. And it just physicalizes the fact that this is the psychological pressure cooker of being a gay man, and again, still, to some extent. It reminds you how strong this was, and I felt like it was so powerful then when the roommate enters the room and interrupts their dance, because that's actually my favorite moment in the play. Mm. When they're all dancing and they're just able to be free and happy with one another, and for a moment they have freedom. And then the straight guy, putatively straight guy, walks into the room and he destroys everything. We feel the presence of his arrival even more strongly because we've seen the gaze that these men have been able to escape by finally getting into that apartment. That creates a psychological fissure in the storytelling that is really exciting.
Sam, what surprised you about this, if anything?
I was surprised by the way this play and this script, which is decades old by now, tackled race and race relations amongst gay men in a way that still felt workable for me now. You know, as soon as I saw that there was going to be a black one and a brown one, I was like, well, they'll be marginalized. And then by the end of it, I kind of respected what they did. And I respected how they handled the ways in which racism and homophobia are intertwined. And I don't want to give away too much of this plot, but I will say, you know, for this to have been written a few decades ago, it didn't come out now in 2020 as problematic for me as I would have expected. I also think that, like, I was surprised by how much by the end of this, and after reading the reviews of it, I found myself coming to the defense of this movie and this play more so for the idea of it than its actual substance.
Yes.
Like, I think artists reserve the right to air their dirty laundry. I think artists from marginalized groups just have that right. Every year there is a conversation amongst black art and black artists over whether or not we should be making this stuff for white folks to see. Can they see our dirty laundry? And to that I say, it's our clothes. If we wash them or we don't, it's our clothes and we can do with them what we want to. And I like the idea of this play still decades on being itself, in spite of what straight people may think, in spite of what other gay people may think. That I think I appreciate more than anything the movie actually did. But I appreciate that so much.
I guess if there was a critique that I do think is fair about doing this play and subsequently this movie at this moment, this trope of visiting a group of predominantly white cis gay men and the dynamics within that group is a thing that we've revisited, you know, if we're talking about the theater canon, like it's a thing that we have for every, let's say, generation and a half, right? Like we have this, we have the Normal Heart, we have Angels in America, we have the Inheritance. Like this is a thing that we sort of come back to. And so I do think there's a fair question to be raised about, you know, the keep coming back to this as opposed to creating new things that sort of widens the lens on queer experience, on gay experience, that sort of thing.
I wondered last night what this movie would look like if Ryan Murphy and company said, you know what? The whole cast is black. The whole cast is Latino. Mm-hmm. The whole cast is lesbians. The whole cast is Asian. Mm-hmm. But what I want to see next for this play is to, like, reimagine the central characters and make them not just the same privileged white guys that we have seen on screen as gay men for decades now.
Right. That is a good direction to take this in, I think, because the movie did resist the impulse to port all kinds of meta meetings and contemporary asides. It kept it as an artifact, kind of preserved in amber. I think that's the way to go, because while this play shouldn't really be forced to be topical, because it is speaking to some pretty dark truths about gay emotional lives, it's always going to be relevant. And there's a difference there. Mm-hmm. Tell us what you think about The Boys in the Band. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. And when we come back, it will be time to talk about what's making us happy this week, so come right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor WeTransfer. We all have doubts, but where do they belong? Are they simply to be surfaced and forgotten? WeTransfer believes your doubt needs a place where it can grow into something useful. And WeTransfer's set of tools can help you do just that by collecting, sketching, presenting, and sharing your thoughts with the world. It's where doubt transforms into ideas. Meet, paste, paper, and collect by WeTransfer. Go to toolstomoveideas.com to learn more.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc. Teladoc is here for you with 24/7 access to board-certified doctors who can diagnose and treat non-emergency conditions like sinus infections, allergies, rashes, and more. And Teladoc's doctors can, where authorized, call in a prescription to be filled at the pharmacy of your choice. Download the app today or visit teladoc.com/NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What's making us happy this week? Tobin Low, what's making you happy this week?
What's making me happy this week is, I guess you would call it a YouTube talk show, sort of. It's called Stars in the House. I thought that this would be appropriate since we're doing sort of a theater-y episode. Basically, it's Seth Rudetsky and James Wesley. They're both Broadway producers. Okay. Seth Rudetsky has played in a million Broadway shows in the pit. They're basically doing like this daily talk show as a fundraiser for the Actors Fund, which supports performers and folks out of work in the entertainment industry. But the reason I love it is because every day they're basically reuniting every Broadway cast you can think of and telling stories about sort of backstage antics and the history of the play itself or the Broadway musical itself. And as a huge theater nerd, it's like candy. I love watching these sort of roundtables and hearing all the stories. And it's sort of like a great daily dose of Broadway if that's what you're missing.
Awesome. Thank you so much. That's perfect. And on theme. Thank you for that, Tobin. Sam Sanders, what's making you happy this week?
You know, I kind of have two things. Let me cheat really quickly. The podcast from KSRW called Lost Notes just did an episode all about Stevie Wonder. And that's all I'm going to say. It is just beautiful. And it catches you off guard. And by the end, you're just crying these happy tears. Go check it out. The other thing is just season 2 of Pin 15. Everyone's already saying it. Believe the hype. It is perfection. And I'm thinking strictly about the episode where the two main characters convince themselves as teenagers that they're witches. And it is this beautiful mashup of like the dreaminess of youth and like also the sadness of real life that begins to hit you once you're a teenager. And they handle the comedy and the drama and the heartbreak that teenage girls can feel so brilliantly. I'm going to stop now and just say that I'm probably going to watch it every week or so for the rest of the year because it's just like it hits every box beautifully.
That's fantastic. Well-deserved praise. Let me tell you, Pen 15 is fantastic. Okay. Mark Blankenship, what is making you happy this week?
All right. If I'm being honest, and I do want to bring honesty here today, what I'm most enjoying this week is watching old episodes of Prime Suspect on Hulu.
Ah.
This is the Helen Mirren long-running series in which she plays Detective Jane Tennyson, or Chief Superintendent of Detectives. She has a different title in every episode, but these are giving me great succor in these times because not only do you get to watch Helen Mirren be amazing across multiple episodes as she solves multiple cases, you also get to see a parade of British character actors before they were famous. So like a super young Johnny Lee Miller, a super young James Frayne, a super young David Thewlis, a super young and scorchingly hot Ralph Fiennes. I mean, like Ralph Fiennes in the very first episode of Prime Suspect is so hot that actually my internet went out. So it's giving me a lot of pleasure to revisit Prime Suspect.
I know what I'm watching tonight.
Yeah, it's great. It's just so fun to see all six British actors in one place. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. What's making me happy this week is I am trying to start up a Dungeons and Dragons game. I played it as a kid. It's experiencing kind of a moment now. I got the books. I got the dice. I got the screen. I got the character sheets. And to get up to speed, because there's a lot more rules than I remember and so much more math. So much more math, you guys. I've been listening to several podcasts featuring people who play D&D. I've been careful in the past to go with those where comedians or at least comedy writers are playing because I've listened to a couple where it's actors. I mean, comedy people are more apt to go for the joke. They keep things at a nice, happy distance. Actors just make a meal out of every emotional beat, and they treat it like an acting exercise, which I have a hard time dealing with. But on a whim, I started listening to Critical Role, R-O-L-E. See what I did there. And that features actors. And at first it was like, see, this is exactly what I was talking about. There's too many characters. I can't tell any of them apart. The episode I started on went on for 3 hours. Some of these episodes go on for 3, 4, 5 hours. And there's hundreds of them. They are sprawling, you know, storylines, all, and they're voice actors. So mostly they just go all in on those accents, boy. And it is so sincere. And anyway, yeah, now I'm hooked. I love it. I can't wait for every new episode. I love it, love it, love it. Now, I should note that I have switched from the podcast to watching them. They have a YouTube channel and they also go live on Twitch every Thursday evening. And that is a far superior experience, let me just tell you, because they are actors and they're often very, 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 very funny. But when they go into a dramatic pause and you're audio only, that can get pretty deadly. But anyway, I highly recommend the web series Critical Role, R-O-L-E. I really do love it, but I can't help feeling like I'm saying, you know, what's good? Try water. If you're thirsty, water, because they are they're huge and they are not the only game in town, but they might as well be. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at G.H. Weldon. You can follow Tobin at Tobin Lowe. You can follow Sam at Sam Sanders. You can follow Mark at I Am Blankenship. And you can follow editor Jessica Reedy at Jessica _ Reedy. You can follow new producer Candace Lim at The Candace Lim. And producer Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band Hello Come In provides the music you are bobbing your head to, or maybe you're not. I don't know your life. Thanks to you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you got a second and you're so inclined, please subscribe to our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. And we will see you all next week when we will be looking back at the last decade of Latinx music.
There are these networks of staunchly pro-gun groups on Facebook. And one of them is run by these three brothers, the Door Brothers. But it turns out, they don't just do guns. The Door family name has been attached to other causes.
Their goal is to eliminate public education and to replace it with Christian schooling.
The Roots of the Door Family on the No Compromise podcast from NPR.